This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location in Annapolis with Mary Jo Bang, who was featured as the poet at St. John's College yesterday. And she is here with two important books which were published within 3 years. And we're going to talk about both of them. But most importantly today, we want to hear from her collection of poems. And what is the title of that book, Mary Jo? And what is it about?
The title, Grace, is a film in which I play everyone. The title itself comes from a quote by David Bowie in response to a fan who asked, "Any movie roles in the future?" Bowie said, "I'm looking for backing for an unauthorized autobiography that I will be writing. Hopefully, this will sell in such huge numbers that I will be able to sue myself for an extraordinary amount of money and finance the film version in which I will play everybody." And when I read that, I thought that is the perfect description of a lyric poem, because there is no one else there, and yet in the poem you have many people, the mother, the father, the beloved, and the poet herself is playing everyone.
You know, this book is so important for so many reasons. First of all, you have two books that came out within 3 years. And so this is the translator for Dante, who is in touch with popular culture, which is so important to know because you collide so many different factions in your work. For instance, the way you take an image and slap it against a philosophical concept. No one does it like you do. Let us hear a poem.
I'll read the title poem, a film in which I play everyone. In scene two, silence is a sleeve. I'm an arm in it. In an outdated Hollywood magazine, I found a photo of someone wearing my hair. How can that be? Now I can't stop thinking about the synaptic sparks over which no one has any control, or they have some control, but not enough to count on in a crisis. I'm making sense all the time of all the senseless endings. A day is as long as the time it takes for the mind to consider life and death countless times, which must make a day plus a night a highway we're only vaguely aware of, since we're busy sitting in a chair or lying on a bed with a floral print bedspread, or walking to the store past someone with a dog on a leash and a phone in their hand, into which they seem to be saying, "This is not what I meant, blah, blah, blah," to an absent ear. Home, you unpack the items you bought, crease the bags flat, stack them out of sight, all without saying a word. This is a non-speaking part. You're an extra. The day you were filmed, on the steps walking into the school dance, the costume you wore was pure you. The set for the scene where everyone disappears was painted Parisian sky blue. The air burned like a curtain on fire. The fire kept going out, then being relit, a trick candle on a cake made of clouds.
I'm glad you read that one, because it exemplifies what I feel about the book. And it is no small matter. You're talking about the self and you're talking about existence. And that is pretty important to try to put on paper and make it permanent. And you do it with sequitur and non sequitur. And this is why your work is so distinctive. Also, the way you do it in surprising combinations makes a prism. And therefore, we have to enter that prism of self. And we, as the reader, start questioning our own identity and our own self. And you did that. And I was thinking, well, she just writes from margin to margin and lets it flow because this is like automatic writing. And then yesterday I heard you say you did not, that you started that way, but now you're kind of close to the line. You know what the line does.
Well, I think it's always intuitive how one writes, but in the revision stage, one goes back in and tries to make certain that it represents how you think. And I think that you were talking about the non sequiturs, but another way of thinking of that is associational leaps. So just like in analysis, you know, a word is said and that triggers another word and that triggers another word, the attempt is to get back to something that is basic, something that is almost unconscious, or to let the unconscious become conscious.
But we cannot teach students to trust that.
Well, I think there are ways to point out in a student's work where perhaps the poem is belabored by biographical details that don't really do any work. And when you cut those away, the evidence of the thinking is more apparent. Otherwise, you know, that's buried.
But no one does it like you do. So let's hear another poem.
I'll read Hanging the Curtain. Hanging the Curtain. The curtain was meant to hide the zoo of my petty vices, but instead it was a coat that kept falling off my shoulders, revealing a watch that kept adding up the hours. After finishing my shift, I sat with a pill in my hand, then thought better of it and dropped it back into its plastic. In the family album, I stood at the edge, a dented girl with a divided mind. Daily, the same awareness. It was only a matter of time before someone would act with cruelty. Now, looking back, I see, will you, won't you join the dance? As the ever-pestering question. In the side yard, six rabbits in a cage, lettuce torn to bits, silent rats consorting with rusting tin cans at the bottom of the drainage ditch. The occasional victims of a stepfather's shotgun. Once a year, fireworks sounded the night out. A weeping shrub occupied the corner yard, the flowering branches bent like water falling from an active fountain. When I hit my limit, I crawled under it to escape the conceptual blur.
Now, that poem could have been in any book, but it's interesting because in reading all of your books, it seems to me that you start with a frame for each book, and so that everything you think and feel fits into that frame. It's like when you write a persona book, everything you think and feel can go into that character. So that is sort of has some narrative to it, but it's also about self, but it's also... Let me start over. If you look at Louise in Love, if you look at Elegy, if you look at this book, Film, you have created a template so that every poem fits into it. Is that the way you write? Do you feel that you feel safer if you have some borders for your thought?
I think of the speaker of the poem as a character on the stage.
In every book?
In every poem.
Yeah, okay.
So, and you have to remember, a book only exists after the fact. You write a poem. You don't know it's going to be a book. You don't know that this is the beginning of something that will grow. So when you go to organize those individual poems, you may create some kind of narrative or the sense of a narrative over the course of the book. Now, in some of the books that you mentioned, Louise in Love, that did begin as this idea of characters, one named Louise, her consort named Ham, and then I wanted to imagine a third person, and I couldn't decide whether it was another woman or another man, and I decided to name that person the other, because in every relationship, there is always an other who's either a rival or another beloved. So that gave me a kind of triumvirate, and then over the course of the book, I found that I needed someone who could embody different feelings and different values than Louise, who was a bit of a wild card. And so I created Lydia, and she was more of a mirror of myself, the poet. And so, you know, these ideas evolve over the course of a writing life, and certainly over the course of the time it takes to collect enough poems to put between two covers.
But surely in a film in which you play everyone, you started with that concept, and every poem, no?
No.
Oh, the poems came first?
The poems came first, and the title came later. And then the title poem got written.
Oh, I'm glad I asked you the question.
Yeah.
Because I thought that they were tailored for the idea from David Bowie.
No, these poems were written primarily during the pandemic. And primarily while I was at work on translating Purgatorio and Paradiso of the Divine Comedy. And so occasionally I would write a poem. And I didn't know where they were going.
Well, I'm glad that you shattered my illusion, because I had this whole idea of you fitting them into this form. That, you heard it first here, everyone. This is a premiere. And let's have another poem. Mary Jo Bang, who has had 9 other books of poems, including the one we're hearing now, A Film in Which I Play Everyone. She's been nominated for many awards, and The Elegy received the National Book Critics Circle Award. She's published translations of Dante's Divine Comedy and Colonies of Paradise, poems by Mateus Goritz. She's also the co-translator with Yuki Tanaka of A Kiss for the Absolute, which we are designating to win a great prize. Let's hear a poem, Mary Jo Bang from St. Louis.
The bread, the butter, the orange marmalade. Nothing was what I wanted. The bread, white chalk. The butter, rancidity. The marmalade, bitterness. The nail on my right hand, the ragged ending to a difficult day. He'd said, "Oh, really? You're wearing that?" "I was," I said. But now there was no room for me in the room. The lights were too bright, always a problem when the windows faced the sun, especially when the sky showed its face for too long. No rain for days, then suddenly rain. I'd worn the red shoes, and now they would be ruined. How to care less? That phrase, I couldn't care less, as if zero were already a viewpoint. There were 2 doors into the house, the front door, which was rarely used, and the side door, which was accessed by entering the screened porch where my stepfather's wood was stacked against the wall. A tall bin of nails anchored the corner. What was he building now? The baby was heavy in my arms. If I put him down, he'd undoubtedly wake. I could tell. Time was a migraine, heading straight for my right eye. The waking baby's cry would be an expert knife through the injured flesh. It was that kind of a season.
I thought I had a scoop yesterday, and I thought, I'm the only one that knows this, and then you talked about it. And it was your endings, your poems. First of all, You said this book is bleak. It is very amusing. It is very witty, ironic, wry. And you might have heard me chuckling in the audience, but your last lines, you bring the poem home, but then you open it up and fan it up as if it's beginning. And I have wish that we would take a lesson from that. So that you said it was like not tying a knot too tight in a ribbon. But it's a very amazing way that you have of fanning out at the closure, you close it, but then you say, this is just the beginning of some thought. And David Keplinger cuts off the last line of everything he writes, every poem he writes, because he wants to open it up. But you close it and open it at the same time. And then you talked about that, so you knew it. I thought I was going to tell you something.
Well, I know what I'd like to do. I never know if I'm successful, so it's good to hear that you feel I am. But I don't want the ending to click shut, mm-hmm. like a little box, mm-hmm. and to suggest in a reductive way, okay, I've said all there is to say, or I've made it perfectly clear. I want the poem to stay open enough that the reader can participate in meaning-making, because I want the poem to be not only for me, but for the reader. And you have to allow, you if you overburden the poem with your own particulars, and the poet becomes rather tyrannical then about, it only means this. I want you to see my life. I want you to be a voyeur on a scene in my life. You know, this particular poem takes a lot of different moments in my life and in other people's lives. So a friend once told me that she had gotten ready to go out and her partner said, "What, you're really wearing that?"
Yeah.
Now, that didn't happen to me, but it happens to the character in this poem. And it's there because it's a shared experience that I think will be useful in this situation.
It has happened to so many women.
Exactly.
That's right. Well, let us hear another poem.
This poem begins with a title from a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins. His poem is spelt from Sybil's leaves. And within that poem, there's this: "Our evening is over us. It's the trading in of the workday categories, hours, clouds that linger inside plate glass corner windows, a man's head blocking the view, to become instead a faint future caption at the bottom of a photo of hibiscus. There is no getting around the fact that each of us is a world of our own, an entity, a pageant of one. Just like you, I feel my way forward, letting the back of my hand brush against the mat wall as I watch the chiaroscuro movie of my mind. Mm. There should be no anxiety in knowing the world will die when we die. This is how it is with us. The real is wherever we are. The days refuse to stay put. Speaking is a way of living with the ruin we were given."
Fabulous last line. You know, things happen to the speaker in this book. It's a quest for self, understanding identity, and how we struggle with that in a way. But other people never affect the speaker, to give the speaker a reflection of who the speaker is. For example, here is the speaker experiencing all these many prismatic experiences. And people are there. The stepfather's there. There's a man there. There's different people. They never help this speaker know who she is, which is so interesting to me. Because in life, we have a sense of ourselves, and then we get a lot from our image from others. Where they overlap is probably where the reality is. But this speaker doesn't take anything from other people to get herself.
I think she's very observational. And I think that there's a sense of isolation in that. And she's trying to learn how the world works by looking at others and by appreciating that. But there's also, the world can be very menacing. So, you know, you wait long enough and there's cruelty, as the poem Hanging the Curtain says. And I think that there's a wariness in that observational stance, which comes from childhood, where you are vulnerable. And so you have to be very careful to continually evaluate other people's state of mind. And I think that that's the state of mind of the character, is she's always trying to figure life out.
That's right. That's clear. That's exactly right. That's what the reader gets. Yes. And you're just the person I've always wanted to ask, where did we get the sense of self in history? I have a theory which is wrong, but I'm thinking, you know, Christianity, the first time that a person tries to direct to God, that would be a way of feeling there was a self. When in the history of humankind do you think we got the idea of self? Because originally people just thought they were part of a tribe.
You know, I think it's impossible to go back and think about or to know how the people in the caves felt, the people walking on the savannah. They have to have a sense of self because they have to be acutely aware. They have to see a movement in the grass that might be a lion.
But that is reactive and instinctive. I think the soul has something to do with self. And I think there's a time in history when we were more than visceral and we knew that we were something, that I was not like you. Well, I guess we'll never know, but it's kind of an interesting thought, isn't it?
Well, it is. I think that, you know, I'm very interested in neuroscience, and that is the bedrock of consciousness. So I think that you say a self, and I would say consciousness. But I think that's why...
I think that is the same thing.
Yes, exactly. But that's why I feel that probably early humans did have consciousness. They're alert, they're awake, they're touching each other. They must have had some kind of frisson, you know, with that when the nerve endings in the skin are stimulated by something. So... I think it's a continuum, and who knows at what point. And the more scientists evaluate animals, they see that animals also have this. They have memory, that squirrels remember where they hid acorns or, you know, any other kind of food stuff. So we don't understand what is basic to the experience of the exposure to air, to water, to each other, to sunlight. It's just impossible to know.
I like that. I also think that animals don't have the same consciousness we do, in that they don't have the same ambitions. There's had to be a time in history where there was, I want something from you, and I'm willing to do this to get it at some point. And I don't know when that is, but I will be very interested to keep trying to learn. And in learning, I learn a lot from your poetry, so please read more. This is Mary Jo Bang, on location in the beautiful city of Annapolis.
Once upon a time, that's all she said. Then it's over. What did she know? She was a ghost-like apparitional sensory effect, chattering in my ear about matters relevant only to me. Like a therapist in a chair, going on and on about last week's conundrum while you lie there, suspended in air, a levitation illusion, a pet shop sketch. For years I'd said yes, but stopped before finishing defining what yes meant. Today I said, yes, I will say no. She nodded her head in agreement. Instantly in front of me, a man, his hand raised. I admit I was afraid of the final cut across my mouth, my lips, flower petals folding in at the edge. Close your eyes, she said. I did. I saw the room I'd hidden in, the single window through which I used to look out at a moon that made the cold night appear as quaint as the pink feathery air after fireworks that drifted slowly over Tetris tile blankets laid out on a beach where the jigsaw interlock of sand grains mocked the ordinary imperfections inherent in any life. The deaths, past and present, in ashes, each discrete moment, a memory palace waiting to be built alongside a suspended high-wire antenna set to receive the unending message, this is what is meant by your one and only life.
Yum. There are some mystics that claim, some spiritual leaders that believe that we make our own reality, and that reality is a creation of our own vision. and that we are the actors in it, and everyone is acting out a script we give them. Now, that's voodoo stuff, but it's pretty interesting, because in your book, you're not far away from that. However, in your book, no one influences the speaker. That, to me, is very interesting. Talk about isolation. No one influences or changes the speaker, as we are changed every day, usually, by our surroundings, our situations. And so, would you speak to that a bit?
I'm interested to hear you say that, because it's something I'm not aware of. I would have to go back and look at all of my books. In this particular book. Certainly, behind the poems, I think that there is a shared effect. There's a response. So that is a change.
There is a response.
The speaker's responding to the world.
That's true.
And so that is a change.
I have to say that.
Yeah.
You got me. There. I have to say that Mary Jo Bang has a BA and an MA in sociology from Northwestern University, a BA in photography from the Polytechnic of Central London, which is now called Westminster University, and an MFA in poetry from Columbia University, and has been the recipient of many fellowships and prizes. Another poem, please.
Green earth, the crush beneath your feet, green grass, the you are here, locator. Your eyes close, you shake your head and think, the sea was once everything we needed. Bowie singing, do you like girls or boys? Bowie saying, I'll finance the film version in which I'll play everybody. The siren gets twinned in the violence of a scene that refuses to end. This is the world is a statement. So is a day will meet the splintered ends of what went before it. The inhumanity, the rottenness. Night rolls in to stand watch, to see if we find our way. This on a rock moving through air, mm-hmm. A century ticking away.
Before we have a final poem, we want the audience to know that this year, you have just produced your final from the trilogy, The Divine Comedy, Paradiso. And we will stay tuned for a program on that, because it is going to be available right now. And it is the third translation by Mary Jo Bang. And here is her final poem.
This is a poem for a poet who died and who was my teacher, Lucy Brock Broido. The Echo for Lucy Brock Broido. The transient snow in a shaken globe was making me think of the Muscovian dome, below which, in a small private room called a cubiculum, I'd read they had buried an empress's golden hair after she died, after they inquired eagerly for the Tsarina, but she was nowhere to be found. From the remotest periods to the present time. Snow becomes rain under the overhead rainforest showerhead, drop by imbecilic drop, dripping onto a broken stone floor. About the absolute fracture that death represents, my brain believes in what I believe. Like any animal, we make our way, amphibian, reptilian, mammalian. Some days more than others, I put away one moment and up comes another, a replenishing gold Virgilian bough. Outside, snow engulfs the asphalt, the sidewalks, the drivers. In a second, it seems, a million trains enter and exit the tunnel. The flood protective walls rise, a tower of torn eaves over a storm-drenched oubliette. The dome dissolves, leaving only the ineffable portion of this time and the idea that we who are still here have kept what was left of her.
the voice of Mary Jo Bang, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress on location. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, and friends of the program, Natalie Canavore and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.